nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So we spent a lot of time on background and review, and now we actually get to do transport. So we're going to do transport in resistors, which might not sound very interesting, but there's some interesting things. 25 years ago, people didn't know this, and now it's something that every electrical engineer needs to know, that resistance is quantized. Right? No matter how short you make the resistor, you can't get the resistance below some quantum of resistance. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I think the review will be really short. It'll just be the model that we're using. And then we'll first of all do ballistic, no scattering at all. And we'll assume that there's a lot of scattering, which is the regime that we're used to dealing with in 606 or whatever semiconductor course we've had. Then we'll have one or two things to talk about. Okay, this is our model of the device, our little nano device. Our device now, in general, it can be a 1D wire, it can be a 2D sheet, like the inversion layer of a MOSFET, or it can be a bulk piece of silicon or some cross-sectional area, some length, or some other semiconductor. We're only doing 1D today. And we've got these ideal contacts and everything, and we're defining the current to be positive when the current flows into the terminal 2. So if we have electron flow, you apply a positive voltage to terminal 2, it attracts electrons, and they flow out, and that's the current flowing in. That's a positive direction for us. And we'll use this Landauer formula, and we will restrict it to small bias. So we think of DFDE as representing F1 minus F2 for a small change in voltage across the two contacts. That's where it comes from. All right, and we've talked about modes. So in this nanowire, we have subbands. And, you know, they have different energies. Depending on where the Fermi level is, we may have one or more of those subbands occupied. Let's just assume that one is occupied to begin with. So M is equal to one. Now, what's interesting about wires is they're very nice. You just have to count the number of subbands at that energy. It doesn't matter if it's parabolic or if it's some complicated numerical dispersion. You look at that energy and you see how many subbands are there at that energy in the wire. Each one is a conducting channel. We have this transmission, and lambda over lambda plus L. We're not going to say a lot about lambda yet. We'll relate it to scattering physics later on. But you can kind of see that it's velocity times the average time between collisions. An electron is going at some velocity. We get this velocity V of E. If it's a parabolic semiconductor, 1/2 mv squared is equal to the kinetic energy. We find out how fast it's moving. And then every tau seconds, it scatters. So you would sort of guess that the mean free path, the average distance between scattering events, is velocity times time. Right. So actually, it's a little more complicated than that, and we'll talk. It's proportional. It's 2 times velocity times time in 1D. It's pi over 2 times velocity times time in 2D. And it's 4/3 velocity times time in 3D. But we'll talk about that later. Something that you need to be aware of. Like if you're reading papers these days and people quote the mean free path, you have to be a little bit careful about what do they mean by mean free path, or you'll be off by factors of pi over 2 and things like that. Okay, so the different transport regimes. If the average distance between scattering events is much longer than the device, and most of them just go across the device and never scatter, we call that ballistic transport, and T is 1. The regime of traditional transport theory we call diffusive transport. The resistor is much longer than the mean free path, so there are many collisions before an electron gets out. T is very, very small. That's the regime when we're talking about current being proportional to mobility. That's the regime that we're working in. And you could be in between. And these days we're frequently in between. And this, you know, one of the things that you want to understand is ballistic is easy. Diffusive is traditional. We know that from our introductory semiconductor course. What do you do if you're in between? And the nice thing about this Landauer formalism is it's easy. T is 1 when you're ballistic. T is lambda over L when you're diffusive. And T is lambda over lambda plus L in between. There's nothing special. It's easy to do. Okay, so let's talk about, you know, what makes current flow. What makes current flow is differences in the Fermi functions of the two contacts. There has to be an F1 minus F2 or current isn't going to want to flow. And we're talking about linear transport. So F1 is almost equal to F2, just not quite. We are applying a small bias. So the way we find out what F2 is, we do a Taylor series expansion. Its Fermi level is a little bit lower if we apply a positive voltage to contact 2. So we just do a Taylor series expansion. If you look in the Fermi function, it's E minus EF. So if I differentiate with E, it's the same thing. There's just a minus sign. That's why we get a minus DFDE. And it's proportional to the difference in Fermi levels in the two contacts, which is, if we've applied a bias, there's a difference in Fermi levels. Okay. But that assumes that the temperature is the same in the two contacts. That might not be the case. One contact might be hotter than the others. So even if the Fermi levels are the same, if one contact is hotter than the other, then F1 will be different than F2. So F1 minus F2 will be non-zero and current will flow. Okay. So there's another driving force. Well, one driving force is difference in Fermi levels, which will correspond to a difference in applied voltages between the two contacts. But the other driving force is difference in temperature. Yeah. This lecture, we're just talking about the first one. The second one comes about when we talk about thermoelectric effects, right? And that's, you know, sometimes it's important in a problem because things just heat up and it's affecting the device and it's a nuisance. Sometimes you're after it because you're trying to make a thermoelectric device. All right, any questions? Okay, so what we're going to do for this lecture then is assume, I've got another notation problem here. T1 is equal to T2. That means the temperature of contact 1 is equal to the temperature of contact 2. Here's a T, by which I mean transmission. I could give them different symbols. All right, but that started getting confusing too. So let's see if this will work. Whenever I write T of E, you know that temperature doesn't depend on energy. So when I'm writing T of E, it means transmission. Right. All right, so we're going to evaluate the conductance, and we want to compare them with things before we took this course. We would have written the conductance something like this. It's NQ times mobility. All right. Now, depending on whether we're 1D, 2D, or 3D, we would do this a little differently. All right. If we look at the units here, N is per centimeter, density per centimeter. Q is charge. Mobility is centimeters squared per volt second. Hey, I have no chalk. All right. So let's look at those units of G. So G is NL, which has units of per centimeter, times charge, which has units of coulombs, times mobility, which has units of centimeters squared per volt second. All right. So this has units of charge over seconds, that's current. Current over voltage then is conductance, 1 over ohms or siemens. So that's the right units. But there's a centimeter here. That's okay, I have a 1 over L. All right, so it's got the right unit. The 1 over L makes sense because if the resistor is twice as long, you'd expect it to have half the conductance. Right? If this were 3D, I would have an A over L. And the A, I would think about a lot of resistors in parallel. If it were a sheet, I would have W over L, and I would think about the widths being in parallel. But I could always figure out what it would be by getting the units right. And this is what we would write down. And the question is, when does this work? And what do we do when it doesn't work? You also know that mobility is Q tau over M. So we want to try to see if we can get that also. All right. So ballistically, there won't be any mobility. Actually, this is kind of an interesting thing. People talk about a ballistic mobility. Maybe we'll talk about that on Friday. But some people think it makes sense. Some people think it's silly to even talk about it. But let's do ballistic transport. So you wouldn't think you should talk about mobility, and I won't talk about mobility. You know, there's no scattering, so there's no Q tau over M. All right, simple little nanowire. And we want to compute the conductance of this thing. All right, we could do it at 0K, which would be really easy. We can do it at finite K, where we have a Fermi-Dirac integral. It's not much harder. All right, we have our Landauer expression. The number of modes, we're only going to consider one subband. So the number of conducting channels is a step function. It's 0 until we get to the bottom of that subband, and then it's 1. And it's ballistic, so the transmission is 1. So I put that into the integral expression. T is 1. The number of conducting channels gives me a step function that starts at the bottom of the first subband. And all I have to do is to figure out this little integral, and we can find out what the conductance is. Right. So this is an integral of the derivative of the Fermi functions, minus the derivative of the Fermi function. Right. We know what the Fermi function looks like. It's 1 well below the Fermi level. It's 0 well above the Fermi level. It makes a transition from 1 to 0 right around the Fermi level in a region of energy, a few kT. Okay. So let's look at how we can evaluate this integral then. We need to take minus df dE, and you can see that that's sharply peaked near the Fermi level. The width is a few kT. And we need to integrate that thing. So, well, let's see. Before I do the integration, I'm going to argue that when you do that integration, you're going to get 1. And you can sort of see it looks like a delta function because it's a sharply peaked thing. In fact, you can show that it is. If I take df dE, integrate it with E, I'm really integrating df from the bottom of the energy to the top of the energy. If the Fermi level is located well above the bottom of the band, then I'm in a region here where F is 1. When I go to high energies plus infinity, F is 0. So if you do this integration, you can see if you do that integration, it's 1. And just by looking at the shape of that function, you can see that it's peaked near EF. So it's got the properties of a delta function. That's what makes T equals 0 nice. We can just treat that thing as a delta function. If I integrate that delta function, I get a 1. So the resistance is 2q squared over h.
Could you locate the epsilon 1, epsilon 2 in the diagram?
Yeah, well, so epsilon 1, I mean, it could be, you know, this is, yeah, epsilon 1 is, depending on where what I've called 0, it's somewhere here. Now, when I do this integration like this, you know, when I'm making this t equals 0, it's easy when I make the t equals 0 assumption. If I plot f, let's say epsilon 1 is here. So when I do this integration at the lower limit, epsilon 1, f is 1. At the upper limit, it's 0. So I can do it that way. Well, the Fermi level is located somewhere here. There's an assumption that the other bands are way up there and they're not occupied. If they were, I would just add them. Now, since I'm really at T, so there are two questions here. This is a good question. If I'm really at t equals 0, then the Fermi function is constant, or it goes abruptly from 1 to 0. Then epsilon 1 could be right below it, and I would get exactly the same answer. If I'm at room temperature, but epsilon 1 is far enough below the Fermi level so that the Fermi function is 1, then the t equals 0 result works at room temperature too. So you commonly use it when you treat metals, for instance. The Fermi level is way above the bottom of the band. You usually assume this T equals zero assumption, even if you're calculating the probabilities at room temperature. Right? Still behaves like a delta function for you. Okay. All right. Any other questions? All right. So that's a nice thing. Makes it work easily. If we have at t equals 0, if we have more than one subband, we just ask ourselves, how many subbands are there? If epsilon 2 was also below the Fermi level, we would have had 2. If epsilon 3 was below there, we would have 3. And we would get 2q squared over h for each one of them. So this 2q squared over h is what's known as the quantum of conductance. Right? That's what you get. For each channel, you get 2q squared over h. And it is either that or zero. It can't be any less than that. So this is known as the quantized conductance. Physicists will write it 2e squared over h. Engineers write it 2q squared over h. E is magnitude of the charge for them. Q is magnitude of the charge for us. The resistance is 1 over that. And it comes quantized in units of 12.8 kilo-ohms. So if you have a resistor and you make it shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, if it has one conducting channel, its resistance is never going to be less than 12.8 kilo-ohms, no matter how short it is. People have actually, I've seen papers where they've measured, put two contacts on a hydrogen molecule, and its resistance is 12.8 kilo-ohms. So 25 years ago, people didn't know that, right? But now it's something that even in practical devices, we have to be aware of. This is one of the first experiments where this was conclusively demonstrated. So this is an experiment. This is done, this is a sheet. So this is known as a modulation doped film, where you'll say probably gallium arsenide. Yeah, it is gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide. You dope the wide band gap aluminum gallium arsenide. The electrons in there spill into the small bandgap gallium arsenide. So now you have lots of electrons in an undoped material. So there aren't the scattering centers you would typically get if you doped a semiconductor to put the electrons in there. So the mobilities are very, very high. So you can get long mean free paths, and you could expect to see ballistic transport. Then in this particular structure, what they're showing in a schematic here, they actually have metal electrodes on the side. And they reverse bias those. And it depletes it. These are electrons, so this is an N-type sheet. If it's wide, if W is wide, it's a 2D resistor, which we're not talking about yet. But if you apply a negative bias to these two side gates, you squeeze it down electrostatically. And you make its electrical width smaller and smaller because you're depleting from the sides. And when you do that, then you start quantum confining them in the width direction more and more, so you get fewer and fewer subbands. And what the plot shows is that if you go to a minus 2 volts, there's your conductance 1 times 2q squared over h. And if you reduce the negative bias, then you electrically make it a little bit wider, and the conductance doesn't go up smoothly. It goes up to 2. Now you have 2 channels. Then you have 3 channels. Then you have 4. So this is a beautiful experiment that showed that resistance really is quantized. If you go to big enough devices, it'll end up being proportional to W. But when W is small and you have a finite number of channels there, you can actually count them. All right. The other thing to note is that as the resistance gets shorter and shorter, the conductance doesn't change. It's not As the resistance gets smaller and smaller, we're in the ballistic limit, so the resistance is independent of the length. Doesn't matter what the length is. All right, questions on that? Now that we've got all the background, we can go quickly. All right, but what if you're at room temperature? And, you know, what if we're in a situation where this Fermi function is broadened and epsilon 1 is there and I can't treat it as a delta function? Then I just have to work the integral out. So I'll work this integral turns out to be one that you can work out pretty easily. And we'll do it because there's a little trick here that you can use for other integrals in the course. So we have this integral that we have to perform. And it has a DFDE. And remember, I got the DFDE by changing it from a DF naught D Fermi level. I'm going to change back to it now because it makes it easier for me to evaluate this integral. Because if I do that, then I can take the derivative outside of the integral. Right? Because the Fermi level is just a constant. It doesn't depend on energy. So I can take it outside the integral energy. And all I have to do is to integrate the Fermi function, and then I differentiate with respect to the Fermi level. All right. So if you integrate that, you can actually integrate that, and it's logarithm 1 plus e to the eta f. And remember, eta f is the location of the Fermi level. It's the distance between the Fermi level and the bottom of the conduction band or subband in units of kT. So if my Fermi level is here and the bottom of the subband is here, it's this distance, EF minus epsilon 1 in units of kT. And that integral is logarithm 1 plus e to the eta f. You can do that one analytically. But that's also, you can recognize that that's a Fermi-Dirac integral of order 0. The Fermi-Dirac integrals have an energy to some power here. Here the power is 0. Okay. So that's a Fermi-Dirac integral of order 0. That one has an analytical solution. But it means that when I do that integral, I get a Fermi-Dirac integral of order 0. Now, EF divided by KT is eta. So what I'm doing here is I'm differentiating the Fermi-Dirac integral with respect to its argument eta. Right. What's that? Pardon me? Yeah, this is one of these things that's, if you read those notes that I recommended you read, it's one of these things that's really useful to remember. It's why we want to write this script F instead of this Roman F, because then we don't have to deal with gamma functions when we do this derivative. If you differentiate the Fermi-Dirac integral with respect to its argument, it just kicks it down one order. So the final result is this. And if eta F is big enough, meaning you're way up here where you're in the case we were before, then F sub minus 1 goes to 1. If you're non-degenerate, it goes to the exponential. All right. So this is our general expression for any temperature. And if we differentiate logarithm 1 plus e to the eta, right, that's the analytical expression for F0, we can get an analytical expression for F sub minus 1. Right? The F sub 1 halves and things are you only can do numerically, but this one we have an analytical expression for. And remember, in the non-degenerate case, all Fermi-Dirac integrals become exponentials. So in the non-degenerate case, we know what the Fermi function is. In the degenerate case, you can see that this Fermi-Dirac integral is going to go to 1. So we get the result that we had before. All right. Now, it's kind of interesting. You know, one of the things, we're used to writing conductance as N, Q, mu. You think of conductance as being proportional to the carrier density. Here it's just 2Q squared over H. It's not proportional to the carrier density. So if I've got a subband, and I have my Fermi level located somewhere above the bottom of the subband, if I raise the Fermi level, I get more and more and more electrons, but I don't get more and more conductance. I just get 2q squared over h. Okay. Why is that? It seems a little odd, doesn't it?
Mobility doesn't make sense, but it is most of the range. That's what it does.
Yeah, maybe we're being fooled because we're doing this thing with mobility here. Yeah. Yeah. Another way to think about this is that, that's right, and we'll talk about this a little more. I'll actually show you, you can write it this way. Although you may wonder, you know, how can you do it this way? But we'll see that you can later on, once we get some scattering in here, right? But what's happening here, or the way you can think about it, is we have EF. And then we have the Fermi level in contact 2, which is just a little bit lower than it. All of the electrons below the Fermi level in contact 2 don't contribute anything to the current. There may be a lot of them. And if I move these things way up in the band, there are more and more of them. But they don't give any current because there's a positive velocity for every negative velocity. The only ones that give any current are this little band here where they're not offset by positive and negative velocities. So as I go up, that just gives me a constant conductance. It doesn't give me any more. All right.
So,
yes.
It means that if you apply the big Walter's difference between the two contacts, that means we're going to just go over the limit, conductance limit, like 2 q squared over h.
No, we could calculate that current, but it wouldn't be 2q squared over h, right? Because this is a low bias result. This is a linear result. If I were to apply a high bias and say I lower the Fermi level in the second contact way down, right? Okay, now all of these positive states are going to contribute to the current. And it's going to depend on where the Fermi level is. I'm going to get a lot more current. But that's a high bias problem, and we're not talking about high bias problems now. So it's the linear resistance, the part when the voltage is small, the current is proportional to voltage. That's the regime where the resistance is quantized. You know, things get nonlinear when you go above there, and it's not even sure what a resistance is. Okay, let's put the scattering in and see what happens. So let's do the traditional case, diffusive. So the transmission is just going to be mean free path divided by length, and it's a very small number. Okay, so all I need to do now is to put lambda divided by L into my conductance expression and work out another integral. Right? Very easy to do. Well, if I do it at T equals 0, or room temperature where the Fermi level is way above the bottom of the subband, I can treat this derivative as a delta function. So the current is just 2q squared over h times the transmission at the Fermi level. So if the mean free path is energy dependent, you know, it'll depend on where the Fermi level is. And there might be more scattering at high energies. So if I raise the Fermi level, T might go down. So it's just 2q squared over h times T. T is the mean free path for electrons that have an energy at the Fermi energy divided by L. Now we're getting something that looks more conventional. We're getting a conductance that's proportional to 1 over the length. If I make the resistor twice as long, I get half the conductance. And that all happens because the transmission is linearly is proportional to 1 over the length of the conductance. Okay. What if we can't assume T is greater than 0? All right, then we just get a little bit of algebra here that... that we can do. And it's all going to depend now. Now we're going to have to actually know something about the scattering processes and what their energy dependence is. Well, we did in the previous time too. Because we have to work out an energy, so we need, or an integral, so we need to know that scattering process. So in general, I could take this integral and I could just divide by integral from epsilon 1 to infinity of minus df naught dE dE, and then multiply by the same thing. The reason for doing that is this is what I had in the ballistic case, that integral. That's f to the minus 1. And this has something, what are the units of this thing?
No.
What are its units?
Unitless.
Yeah, mean free path. There is unitless. I'm sorry. I put a lambda over L in there. Yeah. If I were to pull this L out, what I've really done is, you're right, I'm sorry. But if I were to pull this L out, what I would really have is a definition of what I would call the average mean free path. All right. So here, we pull the L out, then what's left will have the units of centimeters. It'll just be an appropriately weighted energy-dependent mean free path. And all I have to do now is to take my ballistic result, 2q squared over h times f to the minus 1 half, f to the minus 1 a to f, and multiply it by the transmission, average mean free path divided by length. So if the resistor is 100 mean free paths long, the conductance is 1/100th of its ballistic value. Okay, so this is something, you know, if we knew something about the scattering physics, we could work out and figure out what that is. If we were to try to deduce from a measurement, we might fit a measurement to this result and try to deduce experimentally what the average mean free path is. What we would be deducing is this average quantity. And the point is that the conductance is now the ballistic conductance times this ratio, mean free path divided by length. All right, all works out very simply. All right, let's look at some data. Here's some measured data for the IV characteristics of a metallic carbon nanotube. Okay. So you can see, this is current in microamps. This is volts. It's a 1 micrometer long carbon nanotube. We'll think of this as a one-dimensional nanowire. You can see that the IV characteristic is highly nonlinear. Probably later on in the course, when we talk about high field transport, nonlinear transport, we'll come back to this example and talk about the region up here and down here. Well, that would be called hot carrier transport. They have lots of energy. We're very far from equilibrium. More scattering is taking place, which is why the current is rolling off. But what we're focusing on is the linear regime, the small bias, where the current is proportional to voltage. That's, everything we've done is restricted to that regime. So if I look at this regime, I could ask, you know, experimentally, what is the mean free path? You'd be interested. We know the thing is a micron long. What is its mean free path? Are we diffusive? Are we ballistic? Are we somewhere in between? So it's easy to find.
With change of temperature, why cannot she change the IV characteristic?
Why isn't the IV characteristic changing? Yeah.
Yeah,
so it must be telling us that something about the scattering processes that are occurring here don't seem to be displaying a strong temperature dependence. Right. Yeah. So whatever the particular scattering processes are in this case, I know what they are up here, they're optical phonon emission. I'm not sure what they are here, but they're not showing a strong temperature dependence. All right, so first thing we want to find out is what is the conductance? So if I read data off of there, and I tried to read it carefully, so let me go from plus a half a volt to minus half a volt and measure the current at each place, I get a change in current. I think I had about a plus 11 to minus 11. So I got 22 microamps delta I divided by 1 volt. That's 22 microsiemens. Okay, what should the ballistic conductance be? Well, if there's one subband occupied, it turns out that that's a good assumption for this metallic nanotube, then it should be 2q squared over h. Okay, but I've got a 4 here, right? Why?
Spin.
No, the 2 is for spin. The 2 and the 2q squared over h is for spin. I've got another 2. This is a valley degeneracy. You know, carbon nanotubes are like graphene. There's a valley degeneracy of 2. So when you look at the lowest subband, there are 2 of them that are identical, 2 different ones in the Brillouin zone. So there's a 4 there. So, oh, that's what that GV is there. That was a big hint to my question. Valley degeneracy. So the ballistic conductance we would expect to be 154 microsiemens. Well, we know that the actual conductance is mean free path. Let me just assume this is average mean free path, or let me say I'm approximating it by constant mean free path, lambda naught. I could just equate the measured conductance to the theoretical conductance, and I could deduce a mean free path. In this case, it would be 167 nanometers. All right. That's much less than this 1 micron. And that's a reasonably long mean free path, although some carbon nanotubes are quite a bit longer. Some carbon nanotubes are hundreds of nanometers long, but this one's 167. So you can see how you can deduce a mean free path from experimental data. Very simple to do. All right, now another question that is worth thinking about a little bit is, what's the power dissipation? That carbon nanotube is a really small device. So we're applying a voltage, there's current flowing. The power is I times V, or V squared over R. If you compute that power, even though it's microamps of current, you know, the volume of that nanowire is really small. The power density would be enormous. Now, why doesn't it vaporize? Well, so we have to think about, where is this power dissipated? And I'm going to do it in the ballistic resistor, and then we get back to this carbon nanotube thing. And the answer is going to be it's dissipated in the contacts. That's why a lot of these nano devices don't vaporize, because you can pump a lot of current through them, you can dissipate what would be a lot of power for that small volume, but you're dumping most of it into the big contacts. So let's see how that works. Here's our device. We have a ballistic channel. We have 2 contacts. We've separated the Fermi energies by a little bit. We know that all of the current flows between the 2 Fermi energies, right? Because all of the states below both Fermi levels, both contacts are trying to keep them filled. Nothing is moving one way or another. The current is only flowing between the 2. So I might have a current, an electron flowing down here at EF2, giving me current, but I've got a whole distribution in that little energy range. They just flow across that distribution. So on average, they have some energy that's between EF1 and EF2, which, remember, are close together to begin with anyway, because this is small bias. They go out, on average, they have some kinetic energy that's above the Fermi level. Right. They scatter, they dissipate all of that energy in the contact, and they end up going down near the Fermi energy, which is where the empty states are. Okay. Then an electron is kicked out of the metal wire at the Fermi energy. It goes around the external circuit, goes through the battery, gains a little more energy, comes into the first contact, coming in from the metal, so it's coming in at the Fermi energy. And now it fills up that hole. So you can see that it's symmetric under low bias. some half of the energy is dissipated in the left contact, half is dissipated in the right contact. In a ballistic resistor, none is dissipated in the device itself. Right. So why didn't that carbon nanotube vaporize? Because it was, what, seven, eight mean free paths long? So there was a lot of scattering going on inside the nanotube. And yet it wasn't heating up too much, it didn't vaporize. I'm not sure, but I could make a guess.
So it's elastic scattering?
Pardon me?
Elastic scattering?
It probably does a lot of elastic scattering, which lowers the transmission, but doesn't change the energy, right? So the energy still all has to go out to the contacts, and then you can shed the energy. Up at the high bias regime that we haven't talked about, there's a lot of inelastic scattering going on there. But even there, it can't get rid of all of the energy inside the nanotube. It still gets out into the contact, and it's still got most of it. So the contacts are still playing a big role. This is happening more and more in small MOSFETs these days. You know, the hot spots used to develop in the channel, and now these near the drain end, and now these hot spots are developing in the drain itself, because most of them get out with that amount of energy. So the contacts are more and more important. Let's see. Let's see if we can get back to this question. This is what we would have written down based on a conventional semiconductor course. When does this work? Let's see if we can figure out. Actually, it's a little surprising. It works sometimes when you might think that it didn't. So at t equals zero, our expression, we have this nice simple expression. It's the quantum of conductance times mean free path divided by length of the resistor. You don't see any carrier density there. Right. In the diffusive regime, at t greater than zero, we just get this Fermi-Dirac integral. In the non-degenerate regime, Fermi-Dirac integral becomes an exponential. Okay, so let's look at t equals zero, and let's see if we could write the conductance as nq mu divided by L. And actually, it's going to turn out you can. And let's see how this works. You could compute, it'd be a nice little exercise. Maybe I had it in one of the homework problems, I don't remember. You could compute the electron density at t equals zero relatively easily. So the states up to kF are occupied. You have a plus kF and a minus kF. So your entire range is 2 kF. All of the states in 2 kF are occupied. The density of states is 1 over 2 pi times 2 for spin. So the number of states is pi. And if you relate kF to the energy, h bar squared kF squared is equal to h bar squared kF squared over 2m is equal to the Fermi energy. That's what we mean. Then you can derive a relation for the electron density and relate it to the Fermi energy. Okay. That's the thing that's not in this expression. Right? Okay, but look what is in the expression. The mean free path is 2 times velocity times scattering time. By the way, where's that factor of 2 come from? Yeah. So the electron comes along and it scatters off of something. If the scattering is isotropic, what that means is it can send it to any direction with equal probability. In 1D, it means it would send it forward or backward with equal probability. Half the time it's going to send it forward, and it's going to be like no scattering event occurred. So the 2 means I have to go, on average, I need 2 scattering events to flip me around. But there's a velocity here, and then there is a tau, velocity times tau. 1/2 mv squared is equal to kinetic energy. So the velocity is proportional to the square root of energy. The carrier density is proportional to the square root of energy. That means that I can express this relation, 2q squared over h times mean free path divided by L. I can write it as nq mu times 1 over L, just with this algebra. And what I'll find is that mu is just what I would have guessed it to be, Q tau at the Fermi energy over M. Okay. But we're kind of getting this in with an odd argument, right? But it works. And it works in 2D and it works in 3D. In the non-degenerate case, probably no need to belabor this. We have the conductance as being proportional to e to the a to f. And you know carrier densities always go as e to the ef minus bottom of the band over kt. So the carrier density is proportional to e to the a to f. That carrier density at finite temperature is something we can work out with the 1D density of states, you know, integrated over the Fermi function for non-degenerate. And you'll get an expression like this with the 1D effective density of states. If I do a little bit of algebra, then we're going to be able to transform this expression 2q squared over h lambda over L times e to the a to f. I can transform it into something which maybe just looks like a bunch of math right now, but if you stare at it long enough, it should start to make some sense. There are some things there. What is this thing here? Square root of 2kt over pi m. Yeah, so that's something that we're going to see again and again and again. It's what we've called the thermal velocity. Square root of 2kt over pi m. And if I think about this, I have a non-degenerate semiconductor. So when I plot f, it's distributed in a Maxwellian in k-space. It's the average velocity of all of the electrons that have a positive velocity. Right? The average velocity of everything is zero because there's a negative side, but the average velocity of the positive side is square root of 2kt over pi m. So that's velocity. There's a mean free path. There's a kt over q. Now I have to pull something out. We'll see this many times too. I have a mean free path times a thermal velocity divided by 2. Okay. So the dimensions of mean free path times thermal velocity are centimeters times centimeters per second. That's centimeters squared per second. Those are the units of diffusion coefficient. Turns out that is the right definition for diffusion coefficient. And I had a kt over q downstairs. So this stuff becomes diffusion coefficient divided by kt over q. And Einstein tells me d over mu is kt over q. So lo and behold, I end up with nq mu in a non-degenerate case too. Right. So everything makes sense. You know, I mean, this Landauer formalism looks like it's some completely different way to do transport, but it has to reduce to the conventional answers and the appropriate limit and give us the answers that we expect to see. And indeed, it does in many cases, not in all cases. For example, I did this in the degenerate limit. I did it in the non-degenerate limit. I don't think we could do it in between. It wouldn't quite work. Which is one of the reasons, you know, frequently when you're in the lab doing measurements, this is why oftentimes you're in between, right? If you want to get quantitative numbers, and you have to be able to know what to do. All right, that's about it for today. So we started with this formula. We can easily work out 1D resistors. Things to remember are that the ballistic conductance is independent of length because transmission is 1, that there is a lower limit to the resistance given by 1 over 2q squared over h. In the traditional case, the conductance is proportional to 1 over L, and physically that comes because transmission is proportional to 1 over L. And we could think of it this way. At t equals 0, the conductance is 2q squared over h, transmission at the Fermi energy, times mean free path, or times number of channels at the Fermi energy. When we do these integrals for finite temperatures and get these Fermi-Dirac integrals, what we've really computed is some average number of channels times transmission around the Fermi energy. Okay. And we're able to show that we can relate this these Landauer expressions to traditional expressions. When we have diffusive transport and when we have Boltzmann transport, I guess we could also do it at t equals 0. There's a third case. Both of those work. All right, so there's much more that could be said about this. We're not going to say really any more about it in this course. The best reference for this Landauer approach to transport is Professor Dada's book. So if you don't have a copy of that green book, it's something that probably should be on everybody's shelf who does device work. There's a nice review paper here, too, if you want to see more experimental data and how this all works out in practice. All right, if there's any questions? Yes.
The Einstein equation that you have is basically at equilibrium, but we have an out of equilibrium situation.
Yeah, but we are at equilibrium. Everything we're doing for the first 5 or 6 weeks of this class is at equilibrium. We have 3 or 4 weeks in the near the end of the course where we talk about high bias, out of equilibrium, and we'll see that you can define an Einstein relation there, but it's different, right? And you can sort of anticipate what the result would be. Instead of d over mu being k equilibrium lattice temperature over q, it's the electron temperature over q. And the electrons might have much more energy because there's a high bias. Yeah. Okay, so we will tie up some loose ends on Friday then. If there are any questions or things that people want me to discuss, then if you can let me know in advance, I'll try to be prepared for it. We'll see you Friday.